We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
And now New Galaxy Broadcasting presents Inalienable and Free, Voice of the Coalition, a program addressing the grave challenges to human and citizen rights in America and the rest of the world. How can we, the people of Earth, take back the power and privileges granted to us by God and address so significantly in the Declaration of Independence? Our rights are inalienable, that is, given by God and incapable of being taken away from or given by another. These rights are the basis of liberty, the foundation of all life and happiness. The Coalition of Planetary Empowerment is an organization designed to give its members tools and information to empower them personally, in relationships and in business and employment, but also to give them a voice and the ability to help transform political and corporate governance to support the true needs and desires of people throughout the world. Inalienable and Free focuses on the need for government and corporate business interests to be responsive to the will and desire of their constituents and consumer shareholders. Good morning. My name is Johnny Bluestar, host of Inalienable and Free, Voice of the Coalition. The title of this program is a question. Can a blast of statesmanship redeem the Trump administration? Whose statesmanship? Donald J. Trump. Anyone who truly follows my program would realize that Donald Trump is not my favorite politician. As far as I'm concerned, many of his policies are absolutely anathema to what I believe. Among other things, his policies gravely assault human and citizen rights. I believe his policies on the use of military, immigration, the environment, the police, health taxes, etc., all point to one thing: the essential inequality of different classes of people and the value of government favoring the wealthy and privileged. He's also shown to me that his family, or your family, can somehow control the government in a way so that it can be personally financially beneficial to them. His recent announcement that he had the power to pardon himself showed me that he thought he was above the law. But yes, when I listened to some of the mainstream media before his summit meeting, many of whom disliked Trump, there was an overpredominance of skeptical voices, often downsizing the reality of achieving peace in Korea. I think there was a lot of immediate peripheral facts, like his behavior at the G7 summit, that was making people nervous, coupled with his decision to levy tariffs on the goods from Canada, Mexico, and our European allies. In terms of the typical MSNBC and CNN commentators, they were all speculating that Kim would not be willing to go the distance. Hadn't the North Koreans taken our money and run before? Of course, there were primarily alternative media commentators who said that we had reneged on some of the deals and they hadn't followed. Others would say that Trump would accomplish nothing in one day and the whole effort would take 10 to 15 days. Anyway, Kim was just trying to buy time. Despite my severe disapproval of the Trump administration, the concerns of media and many in Congress, I strangely saw a green light ahead. I believe that Kim was serious and that Trump's commitment to this summit was on solid ground and that Kim would go through denuclearization in the right way. And above all, given the stakes, I wanted to be optimistic, but I also felt I'd read the signs right. I saw the initial handshake and a bit of the working lunch, but then given my time zone, I fell asleep. It seemed I was fated to miss the press conference after the summit. I woke up on 2 a.m. Monday and found out it was just the right time to listen to Trump's press conference after the summit with Kim. I still believe that things went all right. Still, I also don't believe that gravely insulting and demeaning people like Justin Trudeau, the president of Canada, gives him the 5 stars in diplomatic behavior. How many people has he treated this way? I also was not very happy of his giving a speech in front of the United Nations and saying he was going to blow up Kim's country. So why should this day be any different? Well, here's how it all began. N45.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. We appreciate it. We're getting ready to go back. Had a tremendous 24 hours. We've had a tremendous 3 months, actually, because this has been going on for quite a while. That was a tape that we gave to Chairman Kim and his people, his representatives, and it captures a lot, captures what could be done. And that's a great place, has the potential to be an incredible place between South Korea, if you think about it, and China. That's got tremendous potential, and I think he understands that, and he wants to do what's right. It's my honor today to address the people of the world following this very historic summit with Chairman Kim Jong-un of North Korea. Spent very intensive hours together, and I think most of you have gotten the signed document, or you will very shortly. It's very comprehensive. It's going to happen. I stand before you as an emissary of the American people to deliver a message of hope and vision and a message of peace. Let me begin by thanking our incredible hosts in Singapore, especially Prime Minister Lee, friend of mine. This is a country of profound grace and beauty, and we send our warmest wishes to every citizen of Singapore who really made this visit so important and so pleasant, despite all of the work and all of the long hours. I also want to thank President Moon of South Korea. He's working hard. In fact, I'll be speaking to him right after we're finished. Prime Minister Abe of Japan, friend of mine, just left our country, and he wants what's right for Japan and for the world. He's a good man. And a very special person, President Xi of China, who has really closed up that border, maybe a little bit less so over the last couple of months, but that's okay. But he really has, and he's a terrific person and a friend of mine and a great leader of his people. I want to thank them for their efforts to help us get to this very historic day. Most importantly, I want to thank Chairman Kim for taking the first bold step toward a bright new future for his people. Our unprecedented meeting, the first between an American president and a leader of North Korea, proves that real change is indeed possible. My meeting with Chairman Kim was honest, direct, and productive. We got to know each other well in a very confined period of time, under very strong circumstance. We're prepared to start a new history, and we're ready to write a new chapter between our nations. Nearly 70 years ago, think of that, 70 years ago, an extremely bloody conflict ravaged the Korean Peninsula. Countless people died in the conflict, including tens of thousands of brave Americans. Yet while the armistice was agreed to, the war never ended to this day, never ended. But now we can all have hope that it will soon end, and it will soon end. The past does not have to define the future. Yesterday's conflict does not have to be tomorrow's war. And as history has proven over and over again, adversaries can indeed become friends. We can honor the sacrifice of our forefathers by replacing the horrors of battle with the blessings of peace. And that's what we're doing, and that's what we have done.
I thought it was a really good speech, and that was the beginning of it. His demeanor, as reflected in those first few minutes, seemed to be strangely presidential, and Trump maintained that demeanor throughout what could have been an extremely contentious press conference had he not remained calm and seriously empathic when he was asked hard, unflinching questions by the press. One of the common statements reflected the idea that we were giving away or owe so much and Kim had done nothing to deserve it. After thinking about it, including the totality of the immediate pre-summit, summit, and post-summit activities, I concluded that not only was Trump's actions presidential, they were statesmanlike, really. I'm going to read a little bit from a New York Times article talking about Kim Jong's image shift from nuclear madman to skillful leader, from dictator to diplomat. This is by Robert Stein, Inara, Tiefen Thaler, and Natalie Renault. How is this possible? You know, Kim ordered his uncle executed and half-brother assassinated. He spent millions developing and testing a hydrogen bomb, an intercontinental ballistic missiles as his people suffered from food shortages. He exchanged threats of nuclear annihilation with President Trump, calling the American leader a mentally deranged U.S. dotard. That was last year's image, but recently, North Korea's Kim Jong-un has achieved one of the most striking transformations in modern diplomacy. The man described by critics as a murderous dictator and nuclear lunatic has held hands and had heart-to-heart talks with South Korea's Moon Jae-in, the president, who has encouraged and abetted Mr. Kim's makeover. Kim has enticed South Korea and the United States into negotiation by dangling the possibility of denuclearizing his country. His popularity has surged in polls in South Korea as he prepares to become the first North Korean leader to meet a sitting president. Whatever his true personality, Mr. Kim has found an avid partner in advancing his new image, Mr. Moon. I'm joined in my program, somebody who always is helping me, but also owns the station, and that's Donald Newsom. Donald, what do you think of this transformation?
Well, to be quite honest, I think it's excellent. I agree with you. The president acted very stately, and he put something together that many presidents have been trying to do for a very long time, and it seems he's a negotiator, a deal maker, and this time he got the deal done. He made the deal, and I'm very proud of him. I just think it's a win all the way around.
What about the transformation of Kim? Does he seem different? I mean, can you account for this?
Well
you remember
Kim,
when he came?
I think I see a new man. I see a man with hope. I see a man with hope for his people. I think he was put by many of the globalists under the gun in a barrel, so to speak. And now he's able to flex a little bit because he doesn't feel that estrangement or that entanglement, let's say. So he seems like a new man. Time will tell. I mean, we have seen that he can be a pretty pretty harsh character, especially like you were saying, where it comes to various assassinations and keeping his state in order. I don't know how all that's going to pan out as far as the kind of guy he is and how he's going to lead his people, but these are interesting times, and he's made some interesting changes. And because he was held under the gun, that could be reason enough for many of his crazy antics. But he came to the table, he's made a deal, and he's looking to negotiate with South Korea. I think, you can only give the man praise right now. I mean, again, it is a... We could always judge people on their past actions, but I'd rather judge him on their current actions. And right now, he seems like he's turned his ship. So, yeah, I just think this is a win-win.
Yeah, I just like, but I look at the guy, when I first saw him, I watched him carefully before, but when he first, said, okay, I'll accept your invitation to Moon Jae-in, and he comes over and he greets him, and you can see almost the love, or the concern, the empathy, everything on his face. And then they're moving into South Korea, and the guy and Moon says, "Hey, I'd like to someday get into North Korea." "Oh, come on over! We can do it right now." I thought that was fantastic. I couldn't believe it, and I've never seen everything he's done, including even the way he reacted to Trump when he closed down the store and everything. There was some problems. North Korea got angry when Bolton decided, well, maybe we should use the Libya methodology on him.
Right.
Yeah, and of course there were war games going on, serious ones, while he was, while all this stuff was going on. So anyway, I want to say that to me, I witnessed a profound transformation, differences in rhetoric, demeanor, openness, a new conciliatory attitude, not only flexible but proactive in trying to demonstrate a reconciliation. So I'm going to go over a few of these things. He brought his sister into the Olympics, had his team march under one flag with the South Koreans, set up a hotline for discussions with South Korea, signed that Pan Mungyom Declaration for Peace, Prosperity, and Unification, the Korean minister, destroyed the hydrogen bomb testing sites, making clearly that he wanted to speak to Trump at any time after Trump seemed to close down the summit, meeting with Putin and Xi, two of the many foreign leaders he'd never met before. Still, I heard people, Don, say that he hadn't done anything. that he was getting far more than he deserved. I thought that was really bizarre. I mean, what did they want him to do? And then he said at the end of this, he's going to destroy a missile testing base. I mean, he packed in so many nice little concessions. Returned our prisoners. Right.
It's amazing. And they haven't given the president any credit for it. And yet he's done things that are remarkable. He's a wheeler dealer. And we saw that through his bankruptcies, through his own businesses. And even Hillary, though, said, you know, the guy's not corruptible. He's incorruptible. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean he's totally incorrupt? I don't think so. But I do.
Trump, I think, is a little bit corrupt.
Right. When you get to that kind of wealth, you probably compromised yourself in a few poor situations. But, you know, we elected the man to come in there and to tell us what the F is wrong with our government and why are all these people in our government against the people and constantly voting against the people and playing with the people. And we needed to know because it was getting pretty scary. I mean, let's be honest. People around the internet were talking, and the New Age movement was beginning out, and people were thinking, you know, the world's going to go down in flames. We're going to have this World War III like they've been planning, and just on and on. And we want to know, how can this be happening when we, the people, are demanding change and our elective representatives are just ignoring us, doing exactly the opposite? Well, we found out, didn't we? It's pedophilia, it's blackmail, and that's pretty much the glue that holds them together. And if they're not being blackmailed, they're a part of the chicanery and buggering kids. And there are very few in that mix of cornflakes that isn't. So this is what we wanted him to do. We didn't think he would be probably the greatest president in the world. That isn't really what we were, I think, putting him in there for. We're putting him in to shake it up. Tell us what's going on, and let's get to the bottom of this stinkhole.
Well, I think that he, unfortunately, I personally think he hasn't really replaced it with very much.
It's tough. They're fighting. He brought in every issue. It's kind of like Bill Maher and his comedic stain on society when he says, you know, hey, why don't we just, you know, let the economy tank. That'll teach Trump. You know, I mean, it's stuff like that. It's the mentality of certain people will do anything. The ends justify the means. And to me, that doesn't work. And that's what we see. So, I'm quite heartened at the way things are going. I believe we do have a statesman in there under President Trump. I truly do. I don't think he's going to get it all right. I think he's going to get much of it wrong, but at least he's behind the people. I do believe that. I truly do.
Well, as you know, friends can differ.
Oh, absolutely.
And on this program, I'm going to present a few things that seem to be a little bit opposite this flash of statesmanship. But what I did, you see, I have never liked what Trump does, as I said in the beginning, except I think on the economy, he's done some valuable things, but he may right now be a little bit overdoing it, but I don't know. But back in August of 2017, I decided to do a spiritual show called Trump Perfected, imagining it if somehow Trump was touched by the right kind of spiritual energy, maybe he would turn around to do the right thing. As far as I could see, as of a few weeks ago, Trump did a lot more wrong things, terrible things, than the right thing. But here's a clip from that original show on N46.
Trump did not choose his base arbitrarily. I'm sure he made alliances carefully and picked a strategy that might help him win with the demographic he chose. The strategy was all about going to war with the globalists. Let's look at the other part of it now. The thing about Trump is he was aware of this stuff. He was aware of it and he talked about it. And the fact that he was aware of it and sort of used it in a way, like allying himself with Alex Jones is an example, where he was comporting himself as part of the resistance. And then when he got into office, he started to choose people that didn't, for his cabinet, that didn't seem to be exactly part of the resistance. It's very complicated. He was caught in all these things. And I think what he has to do is really change a whole lot of his outlook. But he's learning. I think unlike other people who have been president, he is so much of a truly outsider. And he's true. I think he does have a sensitivity. People don't think of it. He's lacking. I saw a little report that he's lacking the empathy gene. But I actually think he has a little bit of that empathy gene. And I think he's repressed it because he's changed a lot of his so-called more conventional old-time liberal thoughts to a very, very high-level, not high-level, but very strong conservative views, including some of the alt-right. So he needs to change his point of view, which is means only one thing. He needs to serve the people. He needs to stop thinking about his base and start thinking about America, because everything that he's doing to concentrate and focus on his base is stripping him of his power to serve America.
Well, on that note, Don, we're going to take a break, and I'm going to play something about how New Galaxy Enterprises, my company, works with people with screenplays, and then as possibly a commentary on what we're talking about, I'm going to play a song called Desperate Games. It's a reflection of a romantic relationship, you might say, going sour, but it also can apply to geopolitics, I think, these days. So that would be C-11 and M-12.
This is Johnny Bluestar, CEO of New Galaxy Enterprises, a media content development company. Initially, I wanted to be a playwright, but once in college, I fell in love with movies and have been writing my own and for clients for many years. No, I'm not entrenched in Hollywood. But I think if you look at my samples, you can determine if I can capture the drama and power of your idea. I'm up to refining your work to professional quality. I've worked on dramatic films, comedy, science fiction, documentaries, and even musicals. I have several books published now that are the beginning of book and film franchises. To learn more about New Galaxy, see samples of our work, or talk to us about your project, please go to www.newgalaxyenterprises.com and fill out the contact form.
Your shadow marks the brazen breeze. I sense you near and slowly freeze. Tempted by your lips and your touch, the cup of you is way too much. I drink from you.
Okay, now I've presented the fact that I think that Trump did a great thing. I don't think it's the only good thing that he did, but this was a phenomenal speech, a phenomenal press conference with someone who doesn't have them very much. But still, let's look at the last few weeks. First of all, let's do you remember this event? Let's see, N29.
Now to developments here in Israel. President Trump made good on his campaign promise to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, now recognized by the U.S. as Israel's capital. In a recorded message played at the opening of the embassy, the only foreign embassy in Jerusalem, Mr. Trump said, "Our greatest hope is for peace." The reality today was violence, especially in Gaza. However, Palestinians who hope to make East Jerusalem their capital stage mass demonstrations, setting fires and throwing firebombs and stones across the border into Israel. Israeli soldiers shot and killed more than 50 Palestinians. More than 1,200 were hurt. We witnessed more protests in the West Bank city of Ramallah. We're going to have more on that in just a moment, but we begin with Holly Williams in Gaza on the deadliest day there since the cross-border war of 2014.
They were angry today in Gaza about the new U.S. embassy. Men and women threw rocks. And while many protesters were peaceful, some started fires along the border fence with Israel. They've been demonstrating here for 6 weeks now, 40,000 of them today, according to Israel, encouraged by Hamas, the militant group that's controlled the Gaza Strip since 2007. Israeli soldiers dropped tear gas canisters from drones. They'd already dropped leaflets warning Palestinians not to get too close to the fence. And when they did, the Israelis used live ammunition.
There are casualties coming back from the fence. Some of them have been shot, and it is utter chaos here.
Palestinians want to return to lands they fled in 1948 when the State of Israel was founded. And they are furious over what they say is American bias towards Israel. But with their slingshots and burning tires, the protesters, including 6 children who were reportedly killed today, seem to be losing their lives for nothing. But many Palestinians, like Hakam Abu Shanab, who wants to study for a master's degree, believe dancing with death is the only way to show their desperation.
You have a very bright future. Are you willing to die here?
Dying here is the only way, or expressing, or at least expressing our feeling to the world, show them that we are dying every day here.
These protests are also fueled by economics. Gaza's been blockaded for more than 10 years now. Nearly half of young people can't find jobs, while most families depend on humanitarian aid.
Holly, just incredible images from Gaza today. We should note that Turkey and South Africa have recalled their ambassadors from Israel. You've been reporting in Gaza for several days now. What is it like there tonight?
Jeff, there's a lot of grief here in Gaza. They'll be burying many of their dead tomorrow. But in general, here in the Gaza Strip, most people are just trying to get on with their lives, despite frequent power cuts and shortages of the goods that they need.
All right, Holly Williams for us. Holly, thank you.
Well, as of a few days ago, the death toll since the protests began is now 129 people killed and more than 13,000 people wounded. You can imagine 13,000. Some of these people have very serious wounds, maybe some amputations, this type of thing. When you shoot people with guns, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. Well, is this worth looking into? Should we investigate it? The UN thought so, but the United States didn't. Let's hear N47.
General Assembly is now voting.
Members of the General Assembly prepare to vote. The resolution aimed at the protection of the Palestinian civilian population against what it calls excessive force. But it took long debate and several procedural votes forced by the U.S. to get to this point. Earlier, intent on making Hamas accountable, the U.S. had introduced an amendment accusing Hamas of being the prominent actor in the ongoing violence. This was opposed by the sponsors of the original resolution, who called for a vote on the amendment to be denied.
This attempt to obstruct a vote on an amendment proposed by the United States is shameful. I call on all member states to oppose this motion and vote no.
62 voted in favor of the amendments, 58 against. But the General Assembly president ruled a two-thirds majority was needed. This disputed by the US, and yet another vote was held to gauge whether there was a simple majority support for the US position. There was not. The Assembly supporting the two-thirds rule by 78 votes against 59, confirming the US amendments had failed to pass.
All of you are very sophisticated diplomats. You know the real thing, and you know the games and the gimmicks, and we trust you fully to do the right thing and to sift between those who try for the last minute for expediency to fool you by introducing amendments, and these are in bad faith because they are not genuine.
The original resolution was vigorously attacked by Israel.
By supporting this resolution, you are empowering Hamas. Over the past 2 months, we have heard from some of the world's worst offenders about the so-called Palestinian Great March of Return. Ismail Haniyeh, the head of the Hamas, President Erdogan of Turkey, and others have expressed their support for these attacks against Israel.
But to no avail. When the vote was finally taken, it was passed by a substantial majority. 120 members voted in favor, 45 abstained, and only 8, including the United States, opposed. While these General Assembly votes are largely symbolic, this one has some teeth. It calls on the Secretary General to look into how best to protect Palestinian civilians, to look at the viability of an international protection force, and to report back to the General Assembly within 60 days. Underlying the sense of urgency and acknowledgement of how serious the crisis on the ground, since the current round of protests began, more than 100 Palestinians have been killed, over 10,000 injured, many by directed sniper fire. Mike Hanna, Al Jazeera, United Nations.
You know what? This is my opinion now. One wonders what kind of a person or country could not see the viciousness and criminality of firing on mostly nonviolent women, children, medical personnel, journalists, and killing dozens and wounding thousands. Nikki Haley thinks that it all can be blamed on Hamas. Well, if you heard my last program or so, you know, there's a certain amount of debate as to how much Hamas was involved. They were certainly helping organize certain things, but whether they were involved with this particular situation with the return. Remember, the embassy was opened on the anniversary of Israel's establishment as a state, 70th year. And it was one day ahead of the Nakba, meaning the catastrophe. That was the day that Palestinians mourned the forced exodus of 700,000 Palestinians from their home because Great Britain at one point loosened up and the United Nations gave them the right to come in there. They came in there and they just made thousands and thousands of people refugees. Now, in this case, 100 snipers are positioned near the border. As far as I know, not one Israeli soldier was killed. Trump did well with North Korea, and I pray for his success. But Nikki Haley's performance at the United Nations shows that more than one person besides Trump is a candidate for transformation. Just imagine, the person who spoke glowingly of peace at the opening of the embassy was Jared Kushner, whose family was close to Netanyahu since childhood. In fact, Netanyahu at one point even slept in his bed and he had to sleep in the couch below. All these people condone Israel's activities. The reality is that a great many Israelis, including their government, regard Palestinians as less than human, deserving to live in filth and degradation in the Gaza Strip, where something like 97% of the water is polluted and dangerous. Those who really understand American values know that our country should be based on the memorable phrase we use all the time in this program, all men are created equal. And our foreign and domestic policy should be based on this fact. And our leaders need to be aligned with that idea. After Nikki Haley's failure to secure the vote, she wanted to condemn Hamas as being the chief operator here. When you have thousands of people celebrating the catastrophe and are very upset about the move of the embassy to Jerusalem, which we all knew was a tremendous concern since that was supposed to be the future capital of the second state. So her aftermath of this thing, her epilogue is that she threatened that the United States might leave the United Nations Human Rights Council. Oh, because actually she didn't want to condemn Israel. And I've heard other things in the Trump administration saying that, well, yeah, it was, you know, the law. We hear that a lot. We're going to hear more about that in this program. So despite Trump's recent flirtation with real democracy, he needs to reach more deeply into his soul to discern who are his friends and who he should stand in opposition to. So let's recall a little bit about what candidate Trump promised when he said he would keep out of foreign wars. He said, "I will never send our finest into battle unless necessary, and I mean absolutely necessary, and will only do so if I plan for a victory with a capital V. The world must know that we do not go abroad in search of enemies." Well, so basically, he said he started to say just fairly recently, he announced that he would be sending more troops to Afghanistan. He stressed there would be no timetable for when these troops would come home, guaranteeing that the longest conflict in American history would drag on well to the future. I'm reading from an article here in Vox. "Conditions on the ground, not arbitrary timetables, will guide our strategy from now on," he said. And Vox goes on, "The speech was a stark reversal for a man who had spent years railing against the war in Afghanistan and calling for a U.S. withdrawal from the country, a fact that wasn't lost on some of Trump's strongest supporters. Before being fired earlier this month," at this article's time, "Steve Bannon used his perch as Trump's chief White House strategist to argue against sending more American troops into Afghanistan." So Trump was in isolation until he wasn't. So I'm going to play something that's very interesting. It's by a guy who is called The Last American Vagabond. He does a daily news report. And let's hear something about our level of military engagement these days.
The United States currently drops 121 bombs a day on countries around the world, which is about one every 12 minutes, which is shocking to say the least, but it also led me to go to the point that if I found it incredibly interesting that it just so happens that the unaccounted for $21 trillion from the Pentagon just so happens to be the exact amount of our current national debt, which if you're interested more about that, check out yesterday's video, but I just found that to be entirely too coincidental. But that being said, there's another point that was brought up in the comment section, actually, that apparently was made by Bernie Sanders recently, which is something that I've actually touched on in the past. But I found it important and relevant to yesterday's show to bring up today, which is the fact that apparently it's being circulated now that the United States is militarily engaged in 76 countries around the world. But they could also make the claim that it's 134 countries around the world, or you could say that it's zero. Ultimately, it depends on how one defines the terms being used in regard to this information. And I believe when Bernie Sanders was pointing this out, he was pulling it from a specific study that was discussed in a few different publications, one specifically being the Business Insider, which essentially pointed out that the United States is militarily engaged in 76 countries in regard to fighting terrorism. I pointed out in the past, I think around 2014-15, that the United States is engaged in 134 countries, at least at the time. I would imagine it's probably engaged in every single country of consequence at this point around the world. But it comes down to the terms being used and how it's manipulated. Because 76 alone is absolutely mind-boggling when you think about it. But really, we're involved in many more countries than that when you just don't make it about terrorism. Where, you know, there's all kinds of different reasons the U.S. military is involved in countries all around the world. But when you really take a moment and stand back and realize 76, 134, the point that the United States is involved in that many countries around the world is staggering. Then you realize that we're dropping 121 bombs a day, one every 12 minutes. Kind of makes sense. But it also, we should also ask ourselves why something that's been around this long, this kind of information, why is it only all of a sudden important when pointed out by someone like Bernie Sanders? Clearly because that reaches a lot of people in the mainstream circles that might not have otherwise seen this information. But it's something, like I said, that we pointed out a long time ago. But we have to begin to realize what's really going on around the world and start looking at this information, or rather finding this information for ourselves, and realize this has been going on for a very long time. And really, if you're someone that is shocked by this information, that the U.S. is currently involved in over 130 countries, ask yourself why you did not know that. Ask yourself why such an important topic, arguably the most important topic, one that is carried out in your name, one that is funded with your ever-increasing tax dollars, is one that you know so little about, all while you're being told you know all there is, that you know all you need to know, at least if you believe the mainstream media, that is.
Didn't Washington, George Washington, that is, warn us in his farewell speech about the danger of foreign entanglements? Now, I definitely believe that the international community should be primed and ready to act if a country wantonly invades another or is committing crimes against humanity, and international law should be set up to make that possible. But the kind of foreign entanglements we are in now are fundamentally self-serving and imperialistic in nature. You take over a country, then position a puppet to do your bidding, you can get the imperial financial benefits without that country losing its appearance of sovereignty. And just to remind people, we overthrew Mossadegh, the first democratic government in Iran, and put the Shah in place, who was a really good Western friend of corporations, but a really strong actor when it came to the use of the Savak, his secret police. And he was overthrown by these clerics in Iran now. So we sort of set the stage for that, because Mossadegh was about to curtail the private investment in the oil. Anyway, so we've discussed a couple of interesting things that have been happening recently, but now let's look at another element requiring our analysis. Trump knew and knows now the terrible plight of DACA, the 800,000 American residents who were brought here as children. Right now, there may be a bill to help them, but it may be highly influenced by Trump's fascinating position on rescuing these longtime residents who have typically never known any place but America. Some months ago, he laid out this position, N49.
We're here today to advance bipartisan immigration reform that serves the needs of the American families, workers, and taxpayers. Well, I also think that after we do DACA, and I really believe we should be able to be successful, I really think we should look in terms of your permanent solution and to the whole situation with immigration. I think a lot of people in this room would agree to that also, but we'll do it in steps. And most people agree with that, I think, Dick. We'll do it in steps. Even you say, let's do this, and then we go phase two. We feel, at least a strong part of this group feels, has to accomplish three vital goals, and it should be a bipartisan bill. It should be a bill of love. Truly, it should be a bill of love, and we can do that. But it also has to be a bill where we're able to secure our border. Second, it has to be a bill to end chain migration. And the other is to cancel the lottery program. They call it visa lottery. I just call it lottery. What I approve is going to be very much reliant on what the people in this room come to me with. I have great confidence in the people. If they come to me with things that I'm not in love with, I'm going to do it because I respect them. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
So anyway, Trump decides to use these innocent young people and their suffering as a bargaining chip to get other more vigorously aggressive efforts in the area of immigration. He speaks of, quote, love in his statements about DACA, but he's willing to risk their fate in order to satisfy elements of his policies that many find troubling. But if these unlucky victims of his policies stand out in the public's mind, there are others, much younger children, who are trapped by his policies in a way that may be creating an insurrection in his own party. You're beginning to hear about this in the news, but it's been going on for a little while. Let's hear N50.
Now to immigration. You've probably seen the headlines in the past few days about what's happening to children who cross the U.S. border without legal documents. We want to take a moment to look deeper at what we know about current policy and who is being affected. Amna Nawaz explains.
Last month, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced his Justice Department, specifically prosecutors in the Southwest, would take a zero-tolerance policy and pursue more criminal prosecutions instead of civil proceedings against migrants crossing the border illegally.
If you cross the border unlawfully, even a first offense, then we're going to prosecute you.
But those prosecutions in general have consequences for the migrants' children. When a parent is taken into custody to face prosecution, any children with them, by law, are placed in the care of a federal agency, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, or HHS, which houses them in temporary shelters.
If you don't want your child to be separated, then don't bring them across the border illegally. It's not our fault that somebody does that.
How many children have been separated from their parents? The numbers aren't clear. The New York Times previously reported that, quote, more than 700 children have been taken from adults claiming to be their parents, including more than 100 under the age of 4. That was for a period from October 2017 to April 2018, the same month Sessions announced more criminal prosecutions for illegal entries. And more prosecutions means more families would be separated. Once they're separated from their parents, those children become classified as unaccompanied minors. Still, other children arrive alone at the border. Last fiscal year alone, U.S. agents took more than 41,000 unaccompanied children into custody. And it's up to HHS to place them in safe settings, with preference given to family, as the children await proceedings. Last year, HHS tried to contact thousands of those kids and their sponsors, but couldn't find them all. The head of the office in charge of their placement was asked about that on Capitol Hill.
Okay. About 1,475 kids out of 7,000, roughly, that you called, you had no idea where they were. That's not 100%. That's about 19% totally unaccounted for. Why did you say 100%?
I was trying to illustrate to the senator that immediately upon release, we know where everyone is, and that time and tides intervene to change that.
That prompted headlines and a social media outcry. HHS now says those nearly 1,500 kids aren't lost. They just didn't answer their 30-day follow-up phone call, a step HHS said it recently added to check up on their well-being. But what do we know about those children? We know many arrived alone at the southern border and that most were from Honduras, Guatemala, or El Salvador, according to government data. And on top of all of this, of course, is the reality migrants face once in custody. And on that point, Judy, there have been a number of recent reports documenting really a pattern of alleged mistreatment in detention. It's everything from inhumane and unsanitary conditions all the way to verbal, physical, and sexual abuse. And that's not just for adults. That's also in the case of children in custody.
And certainly all that requires is going to require and calls for more reporting.
Absolutely.
Amna Nawaz, thank you.
So what does he do? It appears Trump accuses the Democrats of creating the laws that force the hand of its administration. Let's hear 51.
Hey, everybody, it's Jake Tapper from CNN State of the Union and factcheck.org. This week, there's been a lot in the news about families of undocumented immigrants coming into the United States and being separated at the border. One report suggesting that the U.S. government lost track of 1,500 children that were part of these families that were separated at the border. So we want to take a look at a charge President Trump made that this problem and this policy is the fault of Democrats. The president made this claim at a roundtable on so-called sanctuary cities last week at the White House. Take a listen.
We have to break up families. The Democrats gave us that law. It's a horrible thing. We have to break up families. The Democrats gave us that law, and they don't want to do anything about it. They'll leave it like that because they don't want to make any changes. And now you're breaking up families because of the Democrats. It's terrible.
Is that true? Did Democrats give us this law that forces the families of undocumented immigrants to be separated at the border? No, that's not true. Before President Trump took office, many of these families were either processed and released as a family with notice to appear before an immigration court, or they were held in family detention centers together, according to the Bipartisan Policy Center. But in May 2018, the Trump administration announced that all families, all individuals caught entering the United States illegally would be referred to federal prosecutors for criminal charges. Now, under that new plan, a Department of Homeland Security spokesperson says the parents would be placed in detention centers while the children would go to separate juvenile facilities or potentially foster care if they did not have an adult relative in the United States who could take them in. So what law that the Democrats gave us is President Trump referring to when he says the Democrats gave us this law that forces families to be separated, children and parents to be separated? Well, we asked the White House and they referred us to a Department of Homeland Security statement. The statement outlines a 1997 legal settlement that says the Department of Homeland Security can hold children for only 20 days pending their immigration cases, as well as a 2008 human trafficking law that says unaccompanied minors from countries other than Mexico and Canada must be placed in the care of the Office of Refugee Resettlement or with relatives in the United States while they go through removal proceedings. So first, that 1997 legal settlement, that's obviously nothing that the Democrats gave us. It's a legal settlement. Now, the 2008 law, that was passed by the Congress by unanimous consent and was signed into law by George W. Bush, who was the president in 2008. And it doesn't require families to be split apart at the border, though it does limit where and how long the government can hold these children. In fact, experts say that the Trump administration's decision to hold the parents for criminal charges instead of releasing them along with their children is ultimately what will result in the separation of even more families. So, to be clear, neither of the legal examples that the White House gave us forces the Trump administration to separate parents from their children when caught at the border. Not at all. And we're still waiting for any evidence that this is a law that the Democrats gave us, forcing the Trump administration's hand. As of now, we have no evidence that that's the case. A reminder to all you politicians out there, you're perfectly entitled to your own opinions, but not to your own facts. I'm Jake Tapper for CNN State of the Union and factcheck.org.
Well, I so what can you say? That the president of the United States and some of these other people, as you'll hear in a minute, in the administration, are trying to say that it's the law. This is remarkably probably false, but they say more than that. Let's hear N52.
You have seen these stories in recent days where these young babies, the kids, are being taken forcibly from their parents who are crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. And you saw our chief White House correspondent there, Jim Acosta, flat out asking Sarah Sanders, you know, how separating these children from their parents is moral. And he cited something that the Attorney General Jeff Sessions had said today when he was speaking to his, and I'm quoting the AG, to his church friends. So first, if you hadn't seen what Sessions said, here it was. And here's the exchange with Jim and Sarah.
I thought I'd take a little bit of digression here to discuss some concerns raised by our church friends about separation of families. Many of the criticisms raised in recent days are not fair, not logical, and some are contrary to plain law. First, illegal entry into the United States is a crime. It should be, it must be, if you're going to have a legal system and have any limits whatsoever. Persons who violate the law of our nation are subject to prosecution. If you violate the law, you subject yourself to prosecution. And I would cite you to the Apostle Paul and his clear and wise command in Romans 13 to obey the laws of the government because God has ordained the government for his purposes. Orderly and lawful processes are good in themselves, consistent. Fair application of law is in itself a good and moral thing, and that protects the weak. It protects the lawful.
On these children who are being separated from their families as they come across the border, the Attorney General earlier today said that somehow there's a justification for this in the Bible. Where does it say in the Bible that it's moral to take children away from their mothers?
I'm not aware of the Attorney General's comments or what he would be referencing. I can say that it is very biblical to enforce the law. That is actually repeated a number of times throughout the Bible. However, this hold on, Jim, if you'll let me finish. Again, I'm not going to comment on the attorney's specific comments that I haven't seen.
It's in the Bible to follow
the law. That's not what I said, and I know it's hard for you to understand. even short sentences, I guess, but and please don't take my words out of context, but the separation of illegal alien families is the product of the same legal loopholes that Democrats refuse to close, and these laws are the same that have been on the books for over a decade, and the president is simply enforcing them.
Moral policy to take children away from their parents.
Can you imagine the horror that these children must be going through
when they come across the border and they're with their parents, and then suddenly they're pulled away from their parents? Why is the government doing this?
Because it's the law, and that's what the law states.
You guys don't have to do that.
It doesn't have to be the law, and the president has actually called on Democrats in Congress to fix those loopholes. The Democrats have failed to come to the table, failed to help this president close these loopholes and fix this problem. We don't want this to be a problem. The president has tried to address it a number of occasions. We've laid out a proposal, and Democrats simply refuse to do their job and fix the problem. Paula, go ahead. Sorry, Jim, I've given you enough time.
Jim Acosta is there for us. Jim, that was quite an exchange. You asked the right questions. She says the law's been on the books and that it's the Democrats who are to blame and could fix this. What's the truth?
Brooke, I wish I could answer your question. I don't understand simple sentences, apparently, but no.
We know you do, Jim Acosta.
I do my best, even when I'm sleep deprived. But, this is a Trump administration policy to separate these children from their parents as they come across the border. They don't have to do that. That was not the practice during the Obama administration. Obviously, there probably were situations during the Obama administration where, you know, apparently from time to time, they may have had to do that sort of thing. They did detain families from time to time when they came across the border. But this is a new implementation of a policy that has happened under the Trump administration. And we've heard the president say this from time to time in recent weeks, that we wish we didn't have to do this, but we're going to have to do this. And essentially what the White House is trying to do is trying to push the Democrats into a situation where they come to a compromise that involves giving the president much of what he wants on immigration. And what you're seeing right now is sort of a standoff between both parties. But make no mistake, this is a Trump administration policy.
Well, this is really amazing. You know, Don, do you know that the UN has a treaty called the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which sets out the civil, political, economic, social, health, and cultural rights of children? Do you know that there's only one country in the world that has not fully ratified that treaty, Don?
Probably the United States. But
exactly.
I don't put we a lot don't, of stock.
We have not allowed. We have not ratified.
Right, but I'm not big on the United Nations at all. I don't think we should have anything to do with it. I don't think we should give them a dollar. I don't think the United Nations has done anybody any good. And I think a big, large part of our current problem on the global stage, as well as America, is the United Nations and a lot of the criminal activities that's going on within that organization.
Well, I don't think that it hurts to have a treaty which sets out protecting the rights of children, though, right?
Right, but again, when you look at the instrument, you know, a lot of I wouldn't ratify anything, wouldn't put any stock or any support behind anything the United Nations did at this point. Not a thing. So I would be probably more Trump-like in this position when it comes to the United Nations.
Well, I'm not a fan of the United Nations for many reasons either. But I do think that this is the absence of the United Nations not existing. I don't think it's cool that we won't investigate what happened in Gaza because of a veto. I don't think it's right that we should be only a holdout on the rights of the child.
I totally agree with you.
But now we've talked about spiritual transformation, about Trump being transformed. Now, my program here emphasizes the possibility for all men to be connected to the source. And to this state, one can clearly see how the inherent righteousness of the state of awareness is aligned with the core principles of the Declaration of the Constitution. Sometimes personal transformation focuses more on conscience, that part of us that is a mirror of the righteousness of source. What I'm trying to say is this is a big deal. to be connected with Source. And I'm sure you understand what I'm saying, Don, as much as anybody can. But a lot of people probably don't. But let's take a look, dwell on what full transformation might be like. We're going to go back to our show called Trump Perfected, Envisioning the Spiritual Transformation of Our President, and hear a sort of portrait of what this might be like in M53.
The real basics, and this is my theory, when you are trying to become aware of the divine presence, of what another way of putting it would be source consciousness, you're trying to get into a place that links you to God, if you like, called by various names, one of which I like is the Shekinah, which is a Hebrew word. Another one talking about Western religions is the kingdom of God. Most people don't understand that, I would say in the world, don't understand that some of these things that Jesus and other people were talking about, it's a different state of consciousness. It's a state of being aligned with and experiencing a sort of infinite type of power that you're connected to, that just your very essence of your being is connected to, and you're conscious of it. And when you are, there's guidance, there's help, there's a clarification of your real mission, which is different than that part of you, self, which we call the ego, which is separated from that, theoretically, it's separated from that presence. It's funny because the word ego in Latin means I. So we're really saying that most people's sense of I is separated from the divine presence. But when you experience the divine presence, this gives you a whole new way of reacting to the world. And a lot of times, people who are really down and out and alcoholic or addicted to drugs, and they will undergo a certain type of conversion by virtue of the spontaneous awakening of their true nature because they've kind of bottomed out. Now, you see, that's one reason I think there's hope for Donald Trump, because he's bottoming out right now.
Well, no, I agree. And I agree with you. And I do believe that transformation is possible.
And don't you agree, judging from your own experience, and you might discuss that a little bit, that you can actually change a lot of your sort of ethical and spiritual views of what's going on when you have that experience?
Oh, certainly you can. Certainly you can do it. And I do believe that Trump would be no exception. And I do believe that it's possible for the president to experience transformation that would have a direct effect on his presidency.
You know, I think that we've seen a remarkable change in Kim, and I have no idea what it is. I don't know if he got converted or he had a new vision, or if it's just completely acting. But I want to thank you, Don, for helping us out, and for your continual help in overseeing our programs, and also to Doug, your brother, for helping us see the multiple advantages.
I appreciate it. Thank you. I mean that. You're a person with character, honor, heart, love, spirituality, knowledge. You're the full package. And I'm just so happy to have you on this network so we can give some people a little glimpse of the truth from an honorable man.
Well, thank you. I also would like to thank my friend Hassan Khan for his help in all things related to New Galaxy Enterprises. He does a lot of things for me. And he's always there for me for years now, several years. Lynn the Mystic Healer, she makes contributions to us. Andy Miller has also been helpful in trying to help get the stuff about the coalition going. I'd like to say a formal goodbye in a moment, and then we'll go into out with a vintage version of America the Beautiful. Good luck and keep cosmic. So, thanks for joining Dr. Rodier and I on Inalienable and Free, Voice of the Coalition. As we go about developing our new organization, the Coalition for Planetary Empowerment, we hope you will consider the importance of taking part in the electoral processes of your government and asserting the rights you have to vote for the companies you respect and love by casting your ballot as a shareholder or as a consumer with what you buy. We hope soon to make this possible through a social network responsive to your needs to dialogue about your rights as a citizen, but also to be able to effectively act in concert with like-minded colleagues who find representatives of government and business executives will hear your voice and appreciate your message. See you soon.